ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, as the ceasefire deadline approaches, Iran is yet to commit to further peace talks with the US. Also, Woolworths in court, accused by the ACCC of offering dodgy discounts, and a YouTuber's video of fugitive Desi Freeman's last hideout condemned by the Victorian Premier.
It's disrespectful to the men and women of Victoria Police who lost two colleagues, the families of those men. So let's remember those victims, and that's certainly who my thoughts went to immediately when I saw that footage.
First this evening, the end of the two-week ceasefire in the Iran war is fast approaching, even if Donald Trump appears to have extended the deadline a little. The US president now says the deal expires on Wednesday evening US time, later than initially reported. His vice president, J.D. Vance, is reportedly heading to Pakistan soon for further peace talks, but Iranian officials are yet to confirm they're making the trip. Barbara Miller has more.
The US vice president has been holding his diary wide open, and according to reporting by Axios, J.D. Vance will hop on a plane early Tuesday US time, bound for Pakistan for a second round of talks with Iranian negotiators. Donald Trump is expressing confidence the Iranians will come to the table. The US president dialed into the John Fredericks radio show.
Well, they're going to negotiate, and if they don't, they're going to see problems like they've never seen before, and they're going to negotiate, and hopefully they'll make a fair deal, and they'll build their country back up.
But the Iranians are proving a little hard to pin down. They're unhappy about the US blockade of vessels entering and exiting their ports, and about the seizing of an Iranian-flagged container ship. Iran's foreign ministry is calling for the Tuska and its crew to be released. As Iran continues to insist it has no firm plans to head to Pakistan, there's a sense that Washington may need the war to end more than Tehran does. Retired Army General and former CIA Director David Petraeus told CNN he thinks Iran will send a team to Islamabad.
I think the base case is that the vice president gets on a plane, the Iranians then decide, okay, they probably need to go to Islamabad as well, and that the decision is made on some kind of memorandum of understanding that can enable at least the discussions to continue, and therefore you extend the current ceasefire a bit further.
If talks do go ahead, the most pressing issue is the opening of the Strait of Hormuz, Iran's stranglehold on the key shipping lane, exacerbated by the US counter-blockade, is fueling a global energy crisis. After a call with her counterpart in Pakistan, Australia's Foreign Minister Penny Wong said in a statement she had thanked Minister Ishak Dar for his country's role in facilitating negotiations between the US and Iran. We all want the negotiations to be successful, she said, but cautioned that even with a ceasefire, supply pressures would continue for some time to come. And Hormuz is only part of the equation. General David Petraeus again.
We then start to address the really thorny issue, which is, of course, the 1,000 pounds of 60% enriched uranium that is in one or two locations deeply underground in Iran, and for which we need to get that out. And there's going to have to be backs and forths on that, needless to say, a hugely challenging issue.
On that front, Donald Trump was again muddying the waters with a late night post to social media. In it, he repeated claims that Operation Midnight Hammer, that's last June's operation, obliterated Iran's nuclear sites. Digging out the enriched uranium there, he said, would be a long and difficult process. The trouble is, if that's true, it contradicts his statements at the start of the war that Iran was just 2 weeks away from having a nuclear weapon, and it again raises doubts about the rationale for going to war. An NBC poll out this week finds 54% of Americans strongly disapprove of Trump's handling of Iran. Among them, a group of military veterans and their families who took their protest to Capitol Hill, unfurling an American flag and chanting in a congressional building before dozens were cuffed and led off. Army veteran Christina Sarzen was among the group.
We all know from Iraq, from Afghanistan, a war that's 1 month, that becomes 6 months, that becomes 6 years, that becomes a decade. I can see where this is going.
The protesters called on Congress to take action to stop the war. Several resolutions to try and curb the president's actions have so far failed in both the House and Senate. America then, like much of the world, now places its hopes in tentative talks.
Barbara Miller with that report. As the fuel crisis continues, pressure is growing on the federal government to make sure Australians get more revenue from gas exports. Environment groups, crossbenchers and even a Labor backbencher are ramping up calls for a new 25% tax on the gas we send overseas. And a parliamentary inquiry in Canberra today has heard that Australians are losing out, while shareholders in multinational companies benefit from the country's natural resources. Oliver Gordon has more.
Independent Senator David Pocock wants gas producers to pay more tax.
Would it be accurate to say that the tax on offshore gas exports, PRT, is still giving us less revenue than the tax on beer?
In this social media clip, which has been viewed millions of times online, Treasury officials squirm as they confirm to the Senator that yes, beer taxes are bringing in more than the Petroleum Resources Rent Tax, or PRRT.
How do we live in a country, one of the biggest gas exporters in the world, and we're getting more tax from beer than PRRT?
Today, a parliamentary inquiry was held in Canberra to try and find answers to questions like this. But before it began, Labor backbencher Ed Husic, who was spectacularly dumped from cabinet days after the last federal election, went public with his view that the government should slap a 25% tax on gas exports.
If it doesn't happen in this budget, it's not a lost opportunity, it's a missed one.
The government has been tight-lipped about what, if any, changes to resources taxation will be handed down in May's federal budget. But Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, fresh from multiple tours overseas to shore up two-way energy deals, has indicated existing gas contracts would not be impacted by any potential new tax. Opposition leader Angus Taylor has taken a hardline approach and suggested a 25% tax on gas exports would cripple the entire industry.
That's what it says. It says it'll all be over, there'll be no further investment. But that's clearly the intent of it. People want that industry gone.
It's not a view shared by oil industry executive turned Climate Council spokesperson Greg Bourne, one of a number of pro-tax advocates who addressed today's parliamentary inquiry into the issue.
We in Australia are almost uniquely positioned as the country that has taken the least share of the profitability of our resources. Year after year, decade after decade, each of the governments of both colours have been faced down by the oil and gas companies.
Former Greens leader Adam Bandt, now head of the Australian Conservation Foundation, also joined the chorus in favour of increasing taxes.
Gas and coal are the next asbestos and tobacco, and over time people will look back on the Woodside sponsorship of the Dockers and the Nippers and shake their heads and consign it to the dustbin of history in the same way that we did with Benson and Hedges.
Former Treasury boss Ken Henry, another, in support of beefing up taxes on gas companies.
Just do it in the national interest, just do it and stop the crap that the Australian public have put up with for decades now.
Advocates for change have converged on the idea of a flat 25% tax on gas exports. But increasing the revenue raised through the existing PRRT tax is another option. The PRRT is a profit-based tax and applies once companies earn returns above a set threshold. Professor Bruce Mountain is head of the Victoria Energy Policy Centre at Victoria University and says increasing revenue from this tax could be a more equitable way of recouping more from gas companies.
Gas profitability on export varies by location, generally eastern states of Australia versus the north and west. And it varies by energy producer. Our gas comes at different costs, and the investment necessary to extract it and process in it and actually sell it to export companies varies. So simple levies seldom cut it.
And he says the government needs to be wary of any new tax driving away overseas customers.
I do think it's important, and I think it should be part of the consideration of any change to the taxation regime here.
The parliamentary inquiry continues tomorrow, when business groups and representatives of the resources sector are due to appear.
Oliver Gordon. The Queensland inquiry into the operation of the construction union, the CFMEU, has heard explosive evidence of a confrontation between union officials and a Brisbane demolition contractor. The inquiry is examining allegations the union used intimidatory tactics to get what it wanted on a number of Brisbane work sites. It heard today that the demolition contractor was forced to hire a union delegate at the work site, a former professional boxer they believe to be, quote, volatile. Rachel Mealy reports.
Toombul Shopping Centre in Brisbane's north was damaged beyond repair when it was flooded in 2022. Demolition firm the Rosenlund Group was hired the following year to tear down the 10-hectare site. When union officials visited the offices of Rosenlund a few months later, temperatures boiled over. Neil Rosenlund is the owner of the demolition business, and it's him telling the CFMEU officials to get out of his office.
Get out of my building. Gentlemen, please welcome to say, not just this way, I'll go this way. Get out of here. Yes, I'm telling you, won't leave my building. Get out of here.
Today, he was in the witness box at the Queensland inquiry into the operation of the CFMEU and misconduct in the construction industry. He told the inquiry the two union officials came to his company's workplace to talk about pay rates for workers. When the meeting got heated, the union officials told him to leave the meeting.
I was very, very, very upset that they should have the audacity to tell me to get out of my office. I wouldn't dare ever do that to anyone.
Neil Rosenlund's father established the company 50 years ago, and Neil's been working there for 48 years. He says he's seen the industrial landscape change since he started out.
There's good things. It's moved better. Safety's moved far better. We've all seen the old clips about people walking around on the Story Bridge without harnesses, without hard hats, without any sun protection. It's a much better industry.
But he says those changes haven't always been for the better.
The CFMEU union has abused the enterprise bargaining system to their benefit immensely and taken away any power that us and maybe the builders have got or would have had.
Neil Rosenlund told the commission that CFMEU union leader Jade Ingham wielded great power in the industry.
Jade had all the power to make or break companies like ours. We mainly dealt with tier one builders. Tier one builders build the big buildings, and they hire contractors like us, tier one subbies. So we're not going to get the work.
Neil Rosenlund recalled being involved in one of the first ever enterprise bargains on a work site where the negotiation was from both sides.
Now, they just come out here. There's the agreement. Sign it. Or if you don't sign it, don't sign it. But, you know, the implication is you're never going to get a job or you're going to have so many industrial problems on your site. It's no bargain at all. It defeats the definition of the word bargain.
Neil Rosenlund's son Ryan also gave evidence. He told the inquiry that the union had forced him to hire a union delegate on the Toombul Shopping Centre site. That man was a former professional boxer. The inquiry will continue tomorrow.
Rachel Mealy. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on ABC Listen. In the federal court today, the supermarket giant Woolworths has been accused of offering fake discounts on hundreds of products as part of its Prices Dropped marketing program. The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission has brought the case against Woolies. It follows its similar legal action against Coles supermarkets earlier this year. If they lose, the supermarket chains are facing fines in the range of $50 million. The ABC's National Consumer Affairs reporter Michael Atkin has been following the case against Woolworths today. Michael, what's the ACCC's argument in this case against Woolies?
The main argument is that Woolworths has misled shoppers on the prices for 266 items that were put on its Prices Dropped promotions. And it's arguing that Woolworths sold products at one price for a really long period of time, in some cases hundreds of days, before the price was increased for a short period, usually weeks, before it was reduced and put on a Prices Dropped promotion. But the ACCC says that price was usually more than the original price that was being charged, and so wasn't really a discount at all, which is what makes it misleading. And the counsel for the ACCC, Michael Hodge KC, he argued that the power of the Prices Drop promotion was its marketing message, that it told a shopper that Woolworths had done something remarkable.
So how did Woolworths respond to those accusations in its opening statement?
Yes, in response, Woolworths lead counsel Robert Yuzeski SC, he rejected the ACCC claims, as you'd expect, telling the court that Woolworths had provided ample evidence that the prices were genuine. And he said one of the key tests of this was that during the higher price period, they're actually sold in significant quantities, so it was genuine because a lot of those products were walking out the door at that higher price before they were put on the Prices Drop promotion. And he said in almost all of the cases, suppliers had come to Woolworths demanding cost increases on the products. And so part of the argument that Woolworths is making is, well, the ACCC keeps referring to the first price. Well, the first price was no longer relevant because the supplier had asked for a cost increase. There was a lot of inflation around and times had moved on. And it also is insisting that the discount that shoppers received was genuine. What was shown on the ticket was correct, and that it actually also showed not only what the previous price was, but the date the previous price was charged. And so he's saying, well, how could that be considered misleading? It's just a characterisation we reject.
I understand, Michael, that the judge had quite a few questions for the parties today in court. What else did the court hear today?
Yes, one of the fascinating characters in this case and the Coles case is Judge Justice O'Brien, who, in fairness, has pushed back on all of the parties so far. And that was certainly the case today. The ACCC was only a few minutes into its opening when he started interjecting. And one of the things he said to the ACCC is, well, aren't you putting too much emphasis on what consumers would think when they saw these pricing tickets in store? They wouldn't be thinking in these detailed terms about what the price was, you know, 6 months ago or a previous time period, but they were thinking about whether what in fact was shown on the ticket was a genuine discount or not. And they'd be doing that within a matter of seconds, and that, you know, the intellectualisation of what the decision-making process had been from the ACCC might reflect what the ACCC's lawyers would be doing, but as opposed to the regular shopper, he wasn't so sure about that.
Some of these accusations are sounding quite familiar. The ACCC has also run a case against Coles, as you touched on, and we're waiting for the judgment in that one. How similar are the cases, Michael?
Look, they're very similar. Similar number of products, similar time period, similar alleged misconduct, but some of the facts are different and some of the arguments are different. And so the judge is keen to insist that even though they are similar, he has to consider them as separate cases and is insistent he will do so. But no matter what the case, the stakes are massive. So the supermarket giants are facing fines of $50 million or more should they lose. And they're also facing the prospect of class action lawsuit damages and, of course, reputational damage and serious harm there beyond what's already happened should they lose. But conversely for the ACCC, should they lose these cases, its judgment will be called into question, particularly the hot political environment that surrounded supermarket pricing post-COVID. There will be questions about whether that has influenced their judgment in going forward and whether they had weak cases.
Michael Atkin is the ABC's National Consumer Affairs reporter, and the hearings of the ACCC case against Woolworths are expected to continue in the Federal Court in Sydney for the next couple of weeks. In Victoria, police are investigating reports of trespass after social media creators filmed inside the shipping container where fugitive Desi Freeman spent his last days. The police killer was shot dead by officers 3 weeks ago in the state's remote northeast after spending 7 months on the run. As Rachel Hayter reports, it's not the first time YouTubers have been accused of pushing the ethics of content creation to chase an audience.
Inside the fugitive's lair.
Generator, electric fence, I think. And see the heater setup that he had there.
YouTubers filmed the contents of a converted shipping container where the man who killed two police officers had been hiding before his last stand.
There you go, guys. No one's f***ing bringing you this Desi Freeman kind of footage.
And there are good reasons for that. Victoria Police has confirmed it's now investigating reports of trespass related to the video. The Victorian Premier, Jacinta Allan, argues there are ethical concerns too.
It's disrespectful to the men and women of Victoria Police who lost two colleagues. The families of those men.
Detective leading Senior Constable Neil Thompson and Senior Constable Vadim Devar Hotar were shot dead by Freeman at his rural property in Porepunkah in northeast Victoria while executing a search warrant related to historical sexual offences.
There was a huge amount of work went in to bringing an end that will never erase what happened, but an end of some sort as a result of this evil man no longer being here. So let's remember those victims, and that's certainly who my thoughts went to immediately when I saw that footage. My thoughts went to the families of Neil and Vadim, who I know continue to grieve their loss.
Andrew Rule is associate editor and crime writer with the Herald Sun and author of a number of true crime books. He's not a fan of the video either. Least of all, its production quality.
Oh, it's low rent, isn't it? It's very ordinary. Our business, it's a craft. Anybody that practices it can practice it if they're any good. There's an example of somebody who's not. You've got somebody there with a camera and a drone who makes the Collingwood cheer squad look like a meeting of Mensa.
But the mainstream media has republished the material. And Senior Research Fellow in the Centre for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne, Dr. Dennis Muller, takes issue with that.
I thought it was wrong of the professional mass media to republish this material because it was unlawfully obtained. It was obtained allegedly by trespass, and that seems to be obvious. And so if you're going to publish material that's been unlawfully obtained, it's got to be a public interest justification for it. And there is no public interest in this. Lots of public curiosity. That's not the same thing.
But YouTube, where this video was originally posted, is not bound by the ethics of professional journalism.
They would feel no compunction about publishing this, but I think it was wrong ethically for the professional mass media to republish it. Different altogether from a case years ago when the ABC Four Corners published some footage which had been obtained by trespassers into an abattoir in Tasmania to show cruelty to animals. Now, there was a public interest justification, but this is entirely different.
This video of Desi Freeman's hideout is not the first example of YouTubers pushing the ethical limits of content creation to chase an audience. In 2018, American YouTuber Logan Paul apologised after sparking outrage by posting a video showing the body of an apparent suicide victim in a forest in Japan. And just last week, American YouTuber Johnny Somali was sentenced to 6 months in a South Korean prison after filming himself kissing a statue commemorating World War II sex slaves. Victoria Police says it's aware of a video posted online in relation to a report of trespass, and an investigation remains ongoing.
Rachel Hayter with that report. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on ABC Listen. And that's where you'll find ABC News Daily with Sam Hawley each weekday morning too. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. COVID, Ukraine, now Iran. For years, the food supply chain has faced severe pressure, and the cost has been passed on at the supermarket checkout. So, how bad is it this time? Today, we speak to an expert in the costs around our food supply and to South Australian grain grower, Louise Flohr, about the increasing pressures on farmers. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.